years running. Last year I said it's not worth it, so we're going to keep doing it now from now on. But in actuality, I really appreciate the opportunity to take what I do sometimes, which is on a very rarefied level, and try to figure out what is its significance for a more general audience. So I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you also to Rabbi Davis for a very kind announcement in shul yesterday. I'm sure that's why you're all here. And I'd also like to acknowledge Rabbi Parnas, Rosh Kollel, the community who's here. I want to acknowledge at the start, before we get into the material, also that the past day was Rabbi Shlomo Carlebach's 20th Yahrzeit, whose family also escaped Nazi Europe for the U.S. In an early phase in 1939. So may his neshama have an aliyah. And Birshut HaRav, I'd like to start. I thought this year I'd actually try to start with a kind of a context in terms of where we are in the Jewish calendar, so to speak, because it really struck me this year. And I don't know if I just never noticed beforehand or if the timing was different previously. But in the Parshiot right now, we just experienced the destruction of Sdom. Lot and his daughters, the latter thinking themselves, the last people on earth, like Noach and his family before them, were, we might say, among the first survivors in Jewish history. Whereas in this week's Parsha, Sarah Imenu has died, but in the name of the Parsha, we acknowledge her life, as many commentators note, in the theme and the title of the Parsha. So we're caught with these two things in mind. Seemingly disparate themes. One is the theme of the trauma of survival, and the other is the theme of the memory of a matriarch and her important legacy. And I think both of these are very relevant for remembering Kristallnacht. And while they may not exactly align with my talk tonight, they provide something of a stepping off point for Anne Frank, the most famous Holocaust survivor. So I already had one conversation with someone, very quietly, and I'm not going to say who, said, she's not a survivor, right? You know that, Steer. You think, I don't know how long you've been doing this, but maybe it's time for a sabbatical, right? So where did I come up with this audacious, and I hope, honestly, sincerely, I hope not offensive to anyone, title? Well, it turns out that some people are not fully aware that Anne Frank was actually murdered in the Holocaust. For example, Rabbi Julia Neuberger, in a foreword to the exhibition catalog, Anne Frank in the World, which is an exhibition I'm not going to talk about, recounts the following story, and I quote, "A few years ago, I was talking to a school group about being Jewish and what that meant to me. After I'd explained that my mother was a refugee from Nazi Germany, the child asked me whether I thought Anne Frank was the most famous Holocaust survivor. I was stunned by the question. After all, Anne Frank perished in Bergen-Belsen in 1945, age 15. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that the boy was right. Anne Frank is the most famous Holocaust survivor. But what survived was her diary, an intimate journal that led to her memory becoming in some way eternal. As people came to understand what the war against the Jews meant through the words of one young teenager." That's the end of the quote. Now let me add to this, just to stir things up a little bit more, comments by Professor Marianne Hirsch, who elaborates on this issue of finding meaning in this one individual. She says, quote, "Anne Frank continues to function in this way." She's talking specifically about engendering adolescent identification. Many teens read her diary and they identify with her. "For generations of children who identify with her so unproblematically as to write letters to her for school assignments and friend her on Facebook." I don't know how many of you have ever checked out Anne Frank's Facebook page. It has 2.2 million page likes. Now, whether based on a mistaken impression that she survived or a conscious recognition that she died, but that something of her lives on nonetheless, Anne Frank is clearly still very much with us in 2014. So the many forms of Anne Frank's post-Holocaust survival are the subject of tonight's talk. What are the ways in which she has survived? What are the implications for her survival for us today? Now, obviously, Anne Frank has survived in her diary, in photographs of her and in objects she touched, in her persona and in her symbolism, what she represents. And I'm going to speak about some of these forms of survival to varying degrees this evening. Now, concerning the diary, to which I'm not going to devote too much attention, I'll only note that at last count, this book has sold 35 million copies. It's among the top 10 most popular books of all time, somewhere behind the Bible and the Little Red Book of Mao Zedong. And it's had an impact on readers all over the world ever since it was first published, in this case, in the first U.S. edition, which came out in 1952. Now, as just one little example of this phenomenon, we know that the diary of Anne Frank was a treasured object for some of the most famous of South Africa's political prisoners, incarcerated on notorious Robben Island, which is today a museum and a breeding ground for penguins, a hand-copied version trading hands numerous times. In fact, in an early public address as Democratic South Africa's first president in 1994, Nelson Mandela declared that Anne Frank's diary had kept our spirits high and reinforced our confidence in the invisibility of the cause of freedom and justice. You can hear Mandela speak about the importance of the diary and its author to him and to his fellow inmates in a 1995 interview posted on the official Anne Frank YouTube channel, where he lauds her spirit and militant action and calls her one of the great fighters for human rights. We've got to pause for a second and think for a moment. There's a lot of complex layers to this one example that I've just set out. And aside from the political context, which I'm not going to talk about, I want us to think for a moment, what does this example teach us about this issue of Anne Frank's survival? We certainly can see here that she's become larger than life, larger than her death, to the point where she's representing things she never actually represented, like militant action, for example. So these are things that are projected onto her after her death, and which participate in turn in keeping her alive. It's like a feedback loop. The central form of this survival is the posthumously published diary of a young girl, as a text, and also, in the example I gave you, as an object, as an actual physical thing that gets copied, has changed hands. It's certainly true that Frank herself wanted to live on through her writing. This decision crystallized for her while she was in hiding, and well after she had begun keeping her diary, which is something that a lot of people don't realize. Both out of her own developing personal aspirations, and in response in particular to a radio broadcast, the Franks heard on March 28, 1944, when Gerrit Bolkestein, the Dutch government in exile's Minister of Education, Art, and Science, declared, quote, "History cannot be written on the basis of official decisions and documents alone. If our descendants are to understand fully what we as a nation have had to endure and overcome during these years, then what we really need are ordinary documents. A diary, letters from a worker in Germany, a collection of sermons given by a parson or priest. Not until we succeed in bringing together vast quantities of this simple everyday material will the picture of our struggle for freedom be painted in its full depth and glory." End quote. Well, the next day, Frank wrote, "Dear Kitty, Bolkestein, an MP, was speaking in the Dutch News from London, and he said they ought to make a collection of diaries and letters after the war. Of course, they all made a rush at my diary immediately. Just imagine how interesting it would be if I were to publish a romance of the secret annex. The title alone would be enough to make people think it was a detective story. But seriously, it would be quite funny 10 years after the war if people were told how we Jews lived and what we ate and talked about here." So from roughly this point on, Frank began rewriting her diary for posterity on loose sheets of paper, many of which were recovered. It was still a long way to the published versions we have now, but that's another story. Instead, I don't really want to talk about the diary. You know what? I won't be able to see them. Never mind. I don't know. So now I want to talk about her image rather than her writing. Because I believe that it's largely through photographs of her that her image literally survives. And it's worth spending some time looking at these pictures and reflecting on their significance. And you're going to see several images, and several of them are going to be repeated. And I hope you will indulge me for this sort of close reading of an image, because I think there's something to be gained by it. This iconic image of the teenage writer at her desk dates to the winter of 1941 to 1942. So that's about 1.5 years into the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands, when Frank was about 12.5 years old. Remember that her birthday is June 12th, 1929. That's going to become relevant. So this is among the most frequently reproduced and appeared, for example, slightly cropped on the 1967 American paperback edition of her diary. Interestingly, this was also the photo Frank herself selected and pasted into the inside front cover of the red plaid autograph book I showed you earlier, which became her first diary. She affixed it with photo corners, as one would in an album, annotating it right here. It's supposed to work. Right there. "Gorgeous photograph, isn't it?" And over here, Annelise Marie Frank, 1941-1942 winter. This is the source, the only source we have for the photograph's date. But the annotation itself is not dated. So we don't know whether she placed it there before or after the family went into hiding on July 6, 1942. Since it's on the inside cover, it's certainly possible that she may have inserted it before then. If you see, for example, a few years ago, an ABC TV miniseries came out. It's a dramatization of the story without using any words from the diary because they didn't have license to them. And there's a scene where she gets a diary, and the first thing she does is put a photograph of herself inside the front cover. This is before they're in hiding. So it could have happened that way. We don't really know. Now, the entry of September 28, 1942, all around the annotation, appears to have been written around it. So one would assume the annotation concerning the photograph was made before that. But we don't know exactly. So, looking at this photo allows us to think about it as an object and as a record of the past. What is a photograph really? And you have to go back to before digital photography to really think about this. It's a kind of evidence. It's a form of truth. It's a little bit magical. Think about when photography was first developed. I mean, people were a little scared. It was very strange that you could capture an image of a human being like that. And it is really capturing. It's a snapshot, as we all know, in time. It's a moment that's irretrievably lost, right? A second after the photograph, that particular scene, unless you're taking a picture of a piece of fruit sitting there, is gone. The subject could have moved away, could have left. So a photograph is the record and the residue of an event that will never recur. And therefore, it's a reminder of loss, of something to be mourned. And this is something I would like us to bear in mind as we look at a series of photographs tonight. Now, Frank is clearly posing for this picture, right? She's sitting there looking right at the camera. She wasn't caught unawares. She knows her picture is being taken. Maybe she's already thinking about what it's going to be used for. She's transforming herself into a kind of an object for other people after her to be viewing. Now, maybe the intention was only for family, and we'll get to that later as well. We know very little else about the scene here. We don't know who the photographer is. We don't know the precise date. And so this image is both public to us and also profoundly private. And I think we should feel a little uneasy as we're gazing at it. We're looking into, you know, somebody's private life, as it were. And in a lot of ways, the diary bears some of that as well, certainly the original diary. The photo may have been taken at the New Jewish Lyceum in Amsterdam, because after the summer of 1941, Jewish students were no longer allowed to attend schools, including the Montessori school Frank had previously attended, where they were, or where they had been, mixed with non-Jews. She sits at what appears to be a desk with an open book in front of her, and is it something she's reading? Is it something she's writing in? But you know, if we really think about it, the photograph here, and we really should go back to this version of it, it tells us nothing about the Shoah or the ultimate fate of the young woman depicted therein. Anything else we think we know about this photograph comes from what we bring to it. And so what I want to ask us to think about together is, what do these photographs communicate? And how do they communicate that information? What are the tools that we use to read them, as it were? And how much do we have to bring to them in order to make them fully legible? Let's go back to the first American edition of the diary. This photo on the cover of the author in 1939 was selected by her father, Otto Frank. He was the only survivor, you'll recall, of the eight who hid in the annex apartment behind his company's office and warehouse at Prinzengracht 263. Otto Frank actually played an outsized role in his daughter's rise to fame and quote-unquote survival, as it were, serving as a kind of memorial impresario. It was his labor that really brought the diary to publication, particularly in the early years. It was considered not marketable, and it was rejected by a number of publishers before it finally kind of picked up some steam, first in the Dutch edition that was published by Contact, and then eventually in the American edition. Of course, that's when it really took off. But that photo, look at it again, and now look here. Look here. This photo was also a photo the author herself chose as a keepsake to place in her diary, just like that other one, except this one's inside. Selected from photo albums that must have been in the secret annex along with the Franks, likely brought there by their helpers to provide some comfort for the Jews cooped up there for a little over 2 years. And all told, she pasted 19 photographs into her original diary. So this example is a page spread from the first diary notebook, which is available, I should let you know, as a postcard at various Anne Frank institutions. And it includes, on the right side, this same photograph, along with a written entry over here from October 10th, 1942, quote, this is a photograph of me as I wish I looked all the time. Then I might still have a chance of getting to Hollywood. But at present, I'm afraid I usually look quite different. Anne Frank, 10 October 1942, Sunday. We could spend the rest of the evening just parsing this statement its self-deprecating tone, the adolescent wish for fame. Note that this photo is an enlarged version drawn from a series of passport-style photos over on the other side, some of which appear here. Apparently, the Franks would take such photographs annually with great regularity. Evidently, they would go every May to the same place. I'd like to draw our attention, though, to the fact that Frank, at the age of 13, selects as ideal a picture of herself at about the age of 10, and that she's pasting it into her diary 3 months after she and her family have gone into hiding. What was that like? 3 months in, no idea how long this is going to go, and there are these photo albums that she's starting to pull pictures from and looking at them and for who knows how long and pasting this one in, saying this is the ideal image. Passing the long hours of daytime silence the family had to observe. And I think what she's doing is, in a way, memorializing her younger self in a kind of wistful engagement with a more free and innocent time, of which she must by now be painfully aware. And so she's thinking she wants to be 10 again in 1939, before all of this started. Of course, she did make it to Hollywood in a way. Anyone who has been to LA recently, there is a new exhibition at the Museum of Tolerance titled simply Anne. Historically, we should also note that the face gracing the first American edition carries with it an additional sense of innocence, right? Taken in 1939, it likely dates to before the start of the war. Certainly, it originates in a time prior to the German invasion of the Netherlands, which happened on May 10th, 1940, and the onset of anti-Jewish policies there. In terms of the post-war development of Frank's enduring persona, this image in particular helps set in motion her Americanization and the de-Judaization of her persona, which are definitely topics for another talk, but you can ask me about them later. What I want to discuss, though, is a different, lesser-known aspect of her translation into the American context and into the photographic record. In 2004, an exhibition premiered in New York at a gallery titled Anne Frank, A Private Photo Album. This is the slide of the cover of the companion book that was sold at the exhibition. It doesn't have exactly the same title, but the photographs inside are the same ones that were in the exhibition, with one exception. Produced by the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam in collaboration with the Anne Frank Center USA, this traveling exhibition, it just recently closed in Dallas, includes 71 family photographs, some of which had been previously exhibited and published as part of the Anne Frank in the World show, which was the exhibition catalog I started tonight's talk with. These are all photographs taken by her father, Otto, who was not surprisingly the family photographer, considering typical gender roles and dealing with, you know, mechanical devices and things like that, with his Leica camera, which was one of the first to be sold commercially. The familial origin of these photos is therefore important, and Hirsch, I quoted her earlier, writes, quote, "Photographs as the only material traces of an irrecoverable past derive their power and their important cultural role from their embeddedness in the fundamental rights," that's R-I-T-E-S, rights, "of family life." Right? The sharing, the taking of the photographs and the sharing of the photographs and the putting them in albums is a real family project in many contexts. The curator of the exhibition notes that they had all been collected from albums that had been in the secret annex during the period of the Franks' hiding. Needless to say, there are no known photographs taken during the hiding period itself. And I find it striking that the curator of the exhibit speculated on this. Perhaps the annex was too dark. You know, they had to have these blackout shades in it. Or maybe Otto Frank found it too painful. Or maybe he didn't have his camera at hand. Of course he didn't have his camera at hand. And even if he did, do you think he would have been taking pictures of his family while they were in hiding? Do you think that was something that he wanted to preserve and memorialize? This, by the way, is Anne Frank in 1932, so she was about 3 years old in Frankfurt. This one is in the Merwedeplein, which is the new area of Amsterdam where the family had an apartment, where they lived up until when they went into hiding. This is her sister, Margot, and this is Anne over here, presumably at a birthday party. Like any family photo album, the images in this exhibition and accompanying catalog are terribly ordinary. Recording Otto Frank's daughter's milestones, trips to the beach, this is in Zandvoort in August 1934, birthday parties, visits with relatives, and the like. Now, the thing that engages me as a parent, and up until recently the primary photographer of my family, the advent of cell phone cameras has changed things. Talk about that maybe. Is the totally expected absence of Otto Frank in any of these photographs, because he's the one taking the pictures. Right? I know, look at my family pictures, my father's never in them, right? So he's rarely the subject of the images, though curiously his shadow intrudes into and looms over several of them. Well, you see it there, I'm sure, with his head strangely cut off. Here's his daughter outside the Opecta office, her father's business, at Single 400 before they moved to the famous Prinsengracht location in the winter of 1935. The curator of the collection reads these shadows as intentional and not accidental. Besides these photos, there were experiments with light, with his own shadow as an integral part of the composition, and with advertising photography. I don't know. I mean, but his shadow is certainly suggestive, especially if we read back into these images as we are wont to do, the way we look at photographs. Especially if we read back into the images the fact that only Otto survived, and that his shadow in many ways looms over the publication of, and hence the fame that accrued to his younger daughter. So the contemporary view we bring to these photographs really adds an extra dimension. Now, before you get caught up in this, I want to offer the opposing argument, which is that we should be wary of this kind of a practice, which one scholar has called backshadowing, right? Foreshadowing, you read a mystery novel, there's a sharp knife on the counter, it's left behind, and you know, before the evening's over, that knife is going to end up in somebody's back. I'm not talking about FIU. But backshadowing is the opposite process, where you look at something and you say, oh, yeah, well, obvious, you know, like we know. And it's a little bit of a problematic way, so maybe we shouldn't jump at the chance. It gets worse. The volume, and I should have brought it to show you, but I forgot. On the back flap, this is marketing material, it says, "Nothing we see in Otto Frank's photos reveals the horrors that Anne and her family will later have to endure." Yeah. "What we now know about the fate of Anne Frank has an effect on how her book, Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl, is perceived." That's true. "Equally so, it's now impossible to view the photos that portray her life with an impartial eye." True. It may be impossible to do so, but maybe it's important to try. "Should we define these photographs of innocence by the later murder of those pictured in them?" So this collection, Anne Frank and Family, is powerful and suggestive, and it bears a kind of a talismanic relationship to Frank and the others in hiding. The photographs were objects that were there with them, and then they were somehow preserved and collected in this form. They're marked by their physical proximity to the residents of the secret annex. As artifacts, they're also survivors of that episode. Simultaneously, they speak to the innocent time before being forced into hiding, as all but five predate the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands. When we look at these photos, then, we're brought back in time. But they can also be employed for a different kind of time travel. Here's the same photo, Frank in front of her father's former offices, looking pointedly at her watch, but now seamlessly and eerily mashed up with a contemporary photograph of the same address from the Anne Frank House website. To be sure, this is a neat little bit of digital sleight of hand, bringing the past into the present, making it appear relevant, current, engaging. I urge you to check them out. They've got a whole series of these photos, and they are really arresting. And if we think that the photograph bears within it an aura or a residue of the past, here, for example, signified by the precise location where it was taken, today this would be geotagged, then what happens when that image is digitally projected into the present? If we have to be wary of backshadowing, this seems to be exactly the thing that we're not supposed to be doing. A quick reference, just because I can't resist. I gotta turn the lights off for 1 second so you can see this. This is a work of art by Shimon Atti, who's a visual artist, and he has projected in the cityscape of Berlin in 1992-93 the archival photograph of a former resident of exactly the same location onto the contemporary cityscape.
Can you go back one with the lights off, please?
Back one with, I'm going to go forward one with the lights off, the same photo.
We can see back here, though, when we're looking at the
watch. Okay, you're gonna get it in just a second. You know what, I'll leave the lights off. I have enough light here. So this is this, right? And then this is Shimon Atti, and I'm going to go back to that other one in just a second. And by the way, this work is titled Writing on the Wall, Projections in Berlin's Jewish Quarter. And as I said, he slide projected pre-war images of Eastern European Jewish immigrants and places associated with them onto the contemporary Berlin cityscape. So the projections from what was then a working class neighborhood superimposed a kind of memorial screen onto the very public screen of what was fast becoming, at the time, one of the trendiest new areas for West Berliners, who could walk through and around the projections while they were up. So, you know, imagine that when this is actually taking place, it's a kind of a performance piece at night for about 2 weeks, and there are these huge projectors, and they're actually going there, and it's not included here, but you can walk in, and it could have that even a third layer of some sort of contemporary life. But there's nothing physical or material about the Anne Frank House mashup, which in this case takes a pre-war photograph and digitally reinserts it into the post-war cityscape, so that only the contrast between black and white and color and our own awareness of the provenance of the historical image, which I showed you, delineates the difference between past and present, conflating the two. Here, Anne Frank is, as it were, resurrected and reintegrated into the landscape as we, from our comfortable computer screens, track the approaching storm of the Holocaust. Okay. All this leads, for tonight at least, to some work I want to spend a little time with. The remarkable work of an artist named Rachel Schreiber, historian, media artist, and dean of the San Francisco Art Institute. She has a series of 16 photographs titled Anne in New York, which look like a sequence of graffiti tags. Have you spotted her yet? So, right, there she is. Graffiti tags, or maybe missing persons posters. Schreiber describes them as a series of images that investigates the representation of Anne Frank as an American icon of the Holocaust. There's a certain irreverence, I'm still quoting Schreiber, to using Anne Frank's visage in anything other than the sacred context. By doing so, I attempt to wrench the viewer out of the more familiar trappings of Holocaust imagery, barbed wire, flames, black and white images of trains, etc. And the series appears to be a repeated spray-painted stencil of the 1939 photo that was used on the cover of the first American edition, applied to sites throughout Manhattan, including, as we see here, she's on the light pole there, here on a phone booth, see there, a vending cart. Somebody else described this as a hot dog cart. Those aren't hot dogs. And the offices of a local Jewish organization. Probably the closest she ever came, by the way, to an Orthodox Jewish organization. But there's something weird about the photos if you look at them carefully, right? Passers-by are strangely oblivious to these photographs. And it turns out that they're oblivious to them because they're not really there. These are digital manipulations done in the computer lab. They were never out there. Anne was never in New York. So if you read these as a kind of a play on the missing persons photographs that sometimes are reproduced on milk cartons and other places, you can see that Frank here, in Schreiber's view, is a truly missing child. And she's recalled virtually so that no one can happen upon her photo in the street and think, I've seen that face somewhere before. Because the pictures are not really there. Frank has not really survived to become lost again in the streets of New York. What Schreiber provides here, and I think this is significant, is a meditation on absence. Schreiber imagines inserting Frank back into the picture, as it were, as a ghostly, haunting presence from the past, reminding viewers of a crime that has already occurred and a loss that is irretrievable. Now, there's just one more photo of Anne Frank that I'd like to share with you. And this is the final photograph appearing in the exhibition, Anne Frank, A Private Photo Album. And it's possibly the last known picture of her. It was taken in May 1942. Remember that they would go every May to the same place to get the photos taken. And remember that the family went into hiding in July, beginning of July 1942. This is the most widely reproduced photograph of Frank. But it was not among those she pasted into her diary, which fascinates me only in as much as it somehow survived, possibly independently, of the materials that were in the annex. And it survived independently like some other objects. Indeed, some of these objects still turn up. Just this past February, Frank's former non-Jewish playmate and neighbor in the Merveda plane, Tusia Coopers, rediscovered in her attic and donated a box of marbles that Frank had entrusted to her for safekeeping just before the family had gone into hiding. Again, this idea of a palpable presence, the material connection to the past. But what is fascinating about the May 1942 photograph, aside from its longevity, is one way it has been put to use. In a photograph created for the Anne Frank Trust in the UK by a company called Fojo, which specializes in age progression imaging using forensic compositing techniques in order to find missing persons, we see a projection of what Frank might have looked like on her 80th birthday. In a way, to see that again? I worked hours. In a way, this is simply an extension of what any reader of the diary might do, to imagine Frank growing older and taller during her 2 years in hiding, since there's no photographic record of that period. But it's an extension way past her actual lifespan. It goes way beyond her arrest, deportation, transfer, and eventual death in Bergen-Belsen, which, by the way, has also been represented and imagined, and you can see in these two miniseries, and it definitely paints a different kind of a picture. But that's, you know, nothing, it doesn't leave her murder up to the imagination, but we're not looking at those tonight. Now, this visual technique echoes one used in two literary treatments. One of them is Philip Roth's classic 1979 novella, The Ghost Writer. In which a college-age Anne Frank has survived the war, emigrated to America, and taken the name Amy Billette, deciding to remain dead as Anne Frank so that her diary could live. Reflecting on the millions of visitors, this is now written in the late 70s, right? On the millions of visitors to the former secret annex, Amy Anne thinks, I'm quoting Roth here, "They pity me, they pray for me, they beg for my forgiveness. I'm the incarnation of the millions of unlived years robbed from the murdered Jews. It is too late to be alive now. I am a saint." And so the novella progresses with this character deciding that as Anne Frank, she has to remain dead so that the diary can have its own life, and that therefore, painfully, she can't even reveal herself to her own father, that it's just become too late for that. That's Roth. The other literary treatment of this fantasy survival of Anne Frank is by Shalom Auslander. Those of you who have read it know that it is mildly to extremely offensive, depending on where you're holding. But it's also wickedly funny. The book's titled Hope, a Tragedy, and it definitely pushes the bounds of fantasy and taste even further than anyone might previously have imagined, though with profound and provocative and I think ultimately very significant results. The book's protagonist is named Solomon Kugel. He moves to the upstate New York countryside with his wife and young son to get away from the city. His mother, who fantasizes that she is a Holocaust survivor, even though her family has been safely living in the U.S. for generations, this is part of the offensive part of the novel, his mother soon joins them. But then one night, Kugel discovers a real Holocaust survivor living in his own attic. A grotesquely aged and deformed Anne Frank. And it turns out that this Anne Frank has been hiding in attics ever since she survived Bergen-Belsen, taking advantage of a series of families' pity. And I'm quoting from the novel now. This is in her voice, the surviving Anne Frank. "Perhaps it's true that I'm seeking to have it both ways. I want to be Anne Frank without the Holocaust, but I use the Holocaust to subsist, to get what I need. Shelter, food, a place for work, a place to work. To that I plead guilty. But would you have let me stay here if I hadn't told you who I am? I doubt it very much. I am a survivor, Mr. Kugel. Not of this war or that, but as a type. I survive. I do what I have to. I survived death in my youth, and I've been surviving ever since." Here. These various images of surviving Anne Frank's give us much to think about. This, by the way, this series of photographs from 1941 were issued as a postcard by the Anne Frank Funds in Basel, also in commemoration of her 80th birthday. Philip Ross Frank may have survived, but only by assuming a new identity. Ross is a fantasy of survival that wants it both ways. A murdered Frank to serve as the saintly victim and author, and a surviving one allowed to age and experience something of normal life after the war, but under an assumed identity. The former is frozen in time, forever a teenager, or even to some people's minds, younger. Remember the 1939 photograph. The latter lives on like the survivors among us who have succeeded in picking up with their lives, burying the past in favor of the present. Shalom Auslander's Frank, however, poses a challenge to us. She is the traumatized survivor we're reluctant to take in. She doesn't need anything from us and certainly doesn't want our pity. There's nothing of the innocent young girl of the diary here, and nothing of the overused and little understood "I still believe that people are really good at heart" mantra and legacy. In place of the horrors of Frank's death, Auslander gives us the troubling specter of her survival, asking us to imagine a different, much less endearing kind of Anne Frank living among us today. In the end, we see that Anne Frank is in many ways a blank screen, a canvas onto which we can project whichever version of survival we wish to see. In these multiple ways, she's indeed survived the Holocaust. Thank you. And I'm happy to take questions as long as you have patience for them. Oh yeah.
Oh my God.
He's
so angry.
It's so angry.
Right.
He's got it.